Support for the Media Project comes from the College of St. Rose, Albany, New York, offering a Master of Arts in Communications to advance careers in media, PR, and journalism. Fuller part-time options, 518-454-5143. From Northeast Public Radio, this is the Media Project, a weekly discussion about issues confronting the media.
Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They know the lowdown, now it can be told. I'll tell you quite reliably off the record about some charming people I have known. For I meet politicians and grafters by the score, killers plain and fancy, it's really quite a bore. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. They wallow in corruption, crime, and gore. Ting-a-ling-ling, city desk, pull the press, extra, extra, read all about it, it's a mess, meets the test. Oh, newspapermen meet such interesting people. It's wonderful to represent the press.
Well, the Media Project is underway, and we're hoping that we can bring to life here in the program some of the excitement that we just had before the tape began. So here we are with Stu Shinsky, executive editor of the Poughkeepsie Journal.
Gentlemen, how are you?
And director of content, right?
That's content and audience development. I have the longest title in creation. It all means it's my fault.
It's it. That's it. Dr. Alan Shartok, CEO of Northeast Public Radio. No, he's got a longer title than you do. He has more titles than you do.
And letters like PhD. Right.
Yeah, PhD. And there he is. And I'm Rex Smith, editor of the Times Union. That's a pretty short title, editor. That's, you know.
But you're a powerful man. Everybody knows it.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah. Very, very big. Very big. Short name, short title. What can you do? You know, my parents gave me a middle name of William in case I didn't like having a weird first name, Rex, you know, and so I could be Bill Smith if I decided once I grew up that I didn't like having something odd.
Oh, there's a name I'm sure you wouldn't find in the phone book, Bill Smith.
Oh, well, right. Will Smith, however, a famous actor. Anyway, so here we are in the Media Project, a half hour of commentary analysis, and if we're lucky, a little bit of insight into the media issues of the week. We begin with a message from one of our readers. Ruth has written a comment. I am almost speechless, Ruth writes, about the apparent bias on network TV and NPR about the Democratic debate. Public radio seems to have a bias against Bernie Sanders, if not a bias toward Hillary Clinton, and so on and so on. Who in the world can truthfully talk about liberal media bias? It is Republican, if anything, and Hillary when referring to Democrats. It is maddening how brainless all of this is. So,
well, of course, think about that for a second. You can say it's Republican and Hillary, because Hillary's going to be probably the Democratic candidate. But also, there does seem to be an assumption on the part of all of us that Hillary is going to be the candidate, and it ain't going to be Bernie. And by the way, if you're thinking of writing me and saying not to use the word ain't, please, I just use it for emphasis, so cut it out.
So is that a bias on the part of the media, or isn't that what
reality? Does it reflect reality?
Does it reflect reality? I mean, isn't that just counting the numbers and looking at the campaign strategy and what's likely
now
to happen?
Now, if I'm arguing for the Bernieites, I would make the point that because there is this assumption, Bernie can't make any headway, you know, because everybody's assuming it. It's like, did the editor of Pravda ever show up on Meet the Press? Back in the day. Kids, Pravda was the Soviet news organ.
And Soviet is the Soviet Union, pre-Russia. I think Mr. Sanders has gotten his due on this radio station, WNC.
On this one he has.
I think he certainly has had his due.
Bias is usually in the eyes of the beholder.
You know,
people who are, I would venture to say that Ruth, who wrote into us, is surely a Sanders supporter. And there is a lot more bias on the part of media consumers than there is on the part of the media. I mean, that has been my experience throughout my career. People are always accusing us of bias if we don't write things that are just laudatory about their preferred candidates.
Yesterday on our morning panel show that we have, I read two letters back to back, one of which were accusing us of being rabid left-wingers, and the other was accusing us of being tools for the establishment. So that's what it happens.
Which means you're doing just fine.
Well, I don't know necessarily. That would be under the theory of if one foot is on an iceberg and one is in fire, you're healthy.
I got you on that.
Right, Rex. The question is, what happens to whatever's in the middle?
Right. So
following along.
There we go. So anyway, speaking of Sanders, you know, interesting, there was an endorsement for Bernie Sanders by the Communication Workers of America, which is 600,000 members. It's a really big and powerful union, but it has absorbed other unions over the years, including what we used to call the Newspaper Guild, the News Guild, 26,000 members, represents some of the people in my newsroom, as well as, is your newsroom unionized?
Not in our newsroom, no.
Mm-hmm. And so it is interesting that the big union that this is a part of, that...
they endorse Bernie, but that their subunion, the journalists' union, would not, because they were afraid
abstained.
Of being said to be biased, and that's something that a journalist can't afford, right?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. While urging members to take active roles in the political process, they said, it underscores, quote, their need to function with full objectivity. We respect and protect that principle.
Now, Rexy, I would argue with that. See, I have a feeling, and I have violated that my very self, and that is that I think our readers are entitled to know what the person who is writing the story is thinking themselves. You know, Judge Jerome Frank, I've mentioned this before maybe a few thousand times to you guys, the famous jurist, wrote a book in which he said that every judge should be psychoanalyzed before they judged anybody. That way, we would know their prejudices. And I think that since we pretty well assume that anybody who's a reporter is going to vote in an election and may vote for Bernie Sanders or may vote for Hillary, there's an argument to be said, it would be fair for us to know what they're doing.
But we cover so many issues. I mean, how many issues would you divulge?
You have to have a dossier on every reporter in America on every issue that they might possibly cover.
Right. I mean, how do you feel if, for example, we have a reporter who covers Albany City Hall, where solid waste disposal, trash dumping is, I guess, the real word, where trash is a big issue. What if that person is the son of a trash hauler? Or what if that person lives in the city or lives in the suburbs where he pays a collection fee for trash? Does that have to be divulged? And where do you do this? And what stories?
You make a very good point, Rex, except that I would... No, well, here comes the singer. Except that I think I'm not wrong. In other words, the fact that somebody's father is a waste hauler and has been raised in a waste hauling house and loves his father and would never do anything to upset his father or hurt him, might be influential in the way in which somebody covers a story.
It would be, except that reporters are trained to the craft, and the process that we have of having multiple editors read and edit stories is designed specifically to ferret out that kind of bias.
I would bet that there are people who are listening to this radio show.
I'm telling you the truth of how things are done.
No. I heard your truth, in quotes. But I am saying there are people who are listening to this very interesting and, you know, sort of mini debate that we're having here and say, no, Alan's right. Because I remember when there was a story about me and it was clearly prejudiced.
Because it didn't say as many nice things about me as I would.
Well, my wife is furious right now because she's part of a group that is trying to mitigate the proposal for a hotel in downtown Great Barrington, where we live.
And mitigate means they're trying to stop the hotel?
Well, either that or as opposed to being a 95-room hotel, whatever. She and her group think it should be half of that because that's what the town bylaw says. So out comes a newspaper, and the headline on the newspaper is "Would Salvage the..." The word "would" was used. I don't remember the exact headline. But she thought it was prejudicial.
Because the word would is as opposed to...
Would save the old Searle School, which was there, and would save it. But in fact, the argument is that it would not. It would just be a couple of bricks from the old school getting around the town bylaw. She wrote a letter to the paper saying the word "would" is inappropriate because it's, you know, it gives the false impression.
So you think that there's a reporter's bias? Is the reporter in favor of the hotel?
No. I happen to be sort of for the hotel. That's in some version. But the idea that people who are reading this stuff are eagle-eyed, for want of a better term in this case, because it was in the Berkshire Eagle, and so therefore, you know, it may be inappropriate. Well, of course, we all know, especially you editors know, that the headline writer is often not the person who writes the story. Mm-hmm. And therefore, that's always the comeback. from the reporter. I didn't write that, Ted Lay.
Right. I don't think it's a very good example of the case here.
Yeah. I mean, you know.
Nonsense, Alan. Go right ahead.
Interesting. Not sure. I mean, there's a reason that when we vote on Election Day, you know, we're not doing it with a TV camera over our shoulder. We're allowed to vote in private. If you're a reporter, a carpenter, an insurance salesman, or a hobo, you're allowed to cast your vote privately. If it affects the bias of a story or the potential bias of a story, okay, then that discussion can be had. But I'm not so sure that a reporter should be obligated. When they're allowed to vote in private, they need to tell people. And anyone can go down and check voter registration rolls and see if Joe Smith or Mary Smith, and I'm making those names up,
but Rex isn't.
Is registered in a party.
Rex isn't. I know that.
And I'm not either.
I'm not either. I'm a blank, as we call it in New York.
Which in a state like New York is a big error. Because in a state like New York, we often choose the people who are going to have the office based on the political party that they're in.
Because it's a 2-to-1 Democratic enrollment edge in the
yes,
state.
But mm-hmm. even in some districts where it's a Republican enrollment mm-hmm. edge, you lose your real vote because that's the place you would be voting in order to make a difference.
Now, I would say that there is a level of transparency that is important. And in fact, the Code of Conduct, the Code of Ethics of the Society of Professional Journalists requires transparency. Here's an interesting example. The Las Vegas Review-Journal recently was sold for $140 million and for a couple of weeks, nobody knew who the buyer was.
Never disclosed it.
Even the journalists who were working in the Review Journal newsroom didn't know who owned their newspaper. Turns out, we later come to find out, that it's controlled by Sheldon Adelson.
Casino owner, GOP donor.
Yeah, absolutely.
And very conservative gentleman.
Exactly. And so this is an interesting question as to, don't people have a right to know, at least, who owns the media who are serving them? A credit to the Las Vegas Review-Journal, I would say, because the staff is still covering him.
And they broke the story
yes.
of who bought their publication.
They dug into it.
The reporters dug into it and did some good old investigative reporting. And honestly, you would expect them to do that. And they did break the story. What's interesting here is that they had a front page editorial, which is apparently the hot thing now in journalism, front page editorials.
Since the New York Times did it.
Since the New York Times did it a few weeks ago. Saying, we're going to be transparent with our new owner. We're going to do what we're going to do. We're going to dig for the truth. And then I believe it was just yesterday, as we tape this on a Wednesday morning, just yesterday, that there was another front page note, maybe it was this morning, on Wednesday, saying from the owner, basically saying, hey, yes, we're here for you. We will not interfere. But there's another development. The editor left.
Aha.
The editor took a buyout.
Ah.
Suddenly. And is going
and
to be
we don't know what was said in the quiet of that room.
We do yes. not know.
When that That's negotiation
right.
was occurring.
Right. Yeah.
There are a lot of times that this happens. You'll remember some years ago at Newsday on Long Island, my alma mater, the editor and the two managing editors beneath him went in for a meeting with their publisher and did not reappear. For days, they actually left the building. Apparently, there was an effort. The newspaper had just been taken over by Cablevision. The Dolans, the people who own Madison Square Garden and the Knicks and a lot of other stuff. And there was apparently an effort to squelch some stories, to establish editorial control over the newsroom. And the editor, a veteran journalist named John Mancini, who was a young clerk when I was a reporter there, the editor and his two managing editors basically refused. They said, well, we're out of here if you think you're going to run this place and you see what kind of a newsroom you'll have. And the staff was, you know, they kept putting out the paper. But when the editors came back in, it was to the cheers of the newsroom because it was a statement that they had affirmed the independence of the newsroom.
Name that movie.
Name that movie? Is that right? Is that a movie?
The Bridge on the River Kwai, when Alec Guinness comes out and everybody is singing his whistle because he's kept his integrity. Remember
Excellent.
That?
Excellent. Mm-hmm. Yeah. There we go. Well, not a bad thing. Well, it's so rare that journalists get to play the role of hero that I thought we should make note of. Sure.
And we're going to see what happens in Las Vegas.
We will.
You know, because the gentleman who bought this, Mr. Adelson, apparently one of his first announcements that was done before this all came out was he wanted the reporters to investigate some people who oversee the casinos in Las Vegas, which he has a vested interest in. So he apparently was trying to hire his own investigative staff here. So we'll see what the time will tell us over this issue of how this news organization is run,
and
whether
Stewie,
it's for the public
say,
good or not.
And Stewie, when you say we'll see, you have an idea as to what we'll see.
Based on the early returns, I would say that there should be some trepidation in that newsroom.
I think that's a very good point. Now, here's an interesting topic. Moving on, how did the debate moderators used to say that? New topic, next issue, or something like that. Anyway, the issue of off the record and how that actually works and how it is misused. And this has come up in the context of the White House because President Obama did an off the record chat with columnists, maybe 17 or 18 of them.
And NPR was included in that group.
They were in there?
Yeah, I believe so.
Well, somehow this off the record chat, all the information about it winds up on the front page of the New York Times.
Right. Surprise, surprise.
How does that happen?
Well, there are many people, as I have told my students, who have said over the years, there really is no such thing as off the record. And while there are always lectures from guys, erudite people like Rex Smith and Stu Shimsky, who will say, you know, you have to agree on terms before. You have to say, okay, because there's something called off the record, means you can't use it, period. Then there's other stuff.
Not for attribution.
Not for attribution.
But you can use the information, but it didn't come from me.
Yeah.
Right.
So
on background, you know, what does that mean? You know, when you get these terms, you're right. Yeah. You need to define the terms.
But what the rookies don't know, somebody who's with the Chamber of Commerce who has not dealt with you guys, they have to know what this all means, right. And you have to work it out before you go into the room, because if you don't, they'll say, well, there was no such agreement.
What happened here was the White House correspondent for the New York Times, Peter Baker, interviewed a bunch of the people who were in the room. Since he wasn't invited, he was not subject to the off-the-record rule. And the people who were in the room, of course, you have 17 people. People are going to talk about what happened. They're not, I don't mean to say they're not honorable, but people are going to talk. And so he was able to produce this whole story. And in fact, apparently what the president said was not so enlightening that it would have made a difference if he had said it for the record, on the record, at a briefing.
Yeah, Obama apparently told these reporters, quote unquote, off the record, that perhaps he might have been a little slow in responding to the terrorist attacks.
Yes. Now, let us say this. If you have an agreement. Let's say if we follow Alan's example and you do have ground rules established in advance and the reporter says, okay, I'm not going to use this information. Just tell me about it. If you make that commitment, that is a commitment that you're making on behalf of your newspaper. If you make a commitment to say, this is not for attribution, I can use this information, but I can't attribute it to you, that is a contract between the newspaper and the source, not just the reporter.
And it's the heart of any credibility you want to have moving forward, that you honor this. And apparently what happened here was reporters talked to other reporters, which is, honestly, that happens. And then that outside reporter said, well, yeah, I'm not part of this confidentiality thing, so I'm going to write this.
But, you know, I've often wondered about
this. Which is also, frankly, should he have done that? I don't know. I guess he could have.
Obama, you mean?
Well, that the reporter who wrote it for that got the story out there, I mean, he wasn't under the confidentiality thing, but the reporters who talked to him, they didn't print it. That's true. They stayed by the spirit of off the record. It's just sort of, yeah. If I were just Joe Schmo, a carpenter living my life out in Dubuque, Iowa, I would sort of say someone screwed up here and didn't follow what they said.
Yeah, but then there's something else I want to ask you guys about, and it really is related but not absolutely on target, and that is Obama meets with the reporters. And he lets out, yeah, maybe I was a little slow. And this is like, I can only think of sort of other analogies, which I think are inappropriate for this. But why would you tease and say, here's a piece of red meat. I know you guys want
to
use
it. He had to know it would get out. Obama had to know it would get out.
Yeah, I don't think you say anything to reporters that you don't expect them to use when you're the president of the United States.
Bingo.
I don't think you're ever really off the record.
Our governor of New York, Andrew Cuomo, when he meets with people one-on-one, I have reason to believe, says, let's keep this off the record.
Yes, all the time. You know, I mean, he will say that when he starts a conversation. You know, this is just between us, right? you know, and we have people who try to do that in our editorial board meetings. We'll be interviewing somebody for the purpose of editorial, and they'll say, well, off the record, and we immediately say, whoop, you know, there are five people in this room. You can't go off the record when there are five people in the room. We don't take anything off the record.
Because in that case, you have power.
Well,
but when a governor is sitting one-on-one or a president is sitting one-on-one, that person has the power. And you say, no, I'm not going to consent to off the record. You'd have to get up and walk out because otherwise you're done.
And you want to know what he's going to say. I mean, you're sitting there. Your natural curiosity is, oh, geez, what's he going to say to me?
And I think a lot of people have the understanding, particularly people who are not in the media, that if they just say off the record, it's off the record. And that's not how it works. There needs to be that discussion, that agreement, because just because you say it's off the record doesn't mean it really is. It has to be a two-sided discussion.
And for a journalist, what's the value of off the record? If your job is to get and convey information. So to get stuff that you can't use is of no value. If you're Alan Chartok, if you're writing columns, background information is very valuable. So if people, I mean, you don't need to quote people, you need insight. So it's more explicable, more understandable.
It could give context.
Yes, context.
Yeah, it could give context. Yeah,
I don't need context. I don't need context. I have all the context I need. Thank you very much.
I got it in my head.
It's those letters, Rex, PhD.
I've been around for a long time.
Dr. Alan Chartok, Stu Shinsky, and Rex Smith here in the Media Project. If you want to share your views, media@wamc.org.
And it won't be off the record if
and
you
it
write
won't
to
be
us.
Off the, yes, that's right. We do usually not use people's.
Oh, but we get letters.
Last name.
That says anonymous or off the record.
Yeah.
Come on, don't do that.
So we just need to look back at 2015 and say, what was the biggest story of the year? You know, it's been an amazing year, 2015. Yes. The migrant crisis, climate change, the election campaign, mass shootings, black deaths and encounters with police. Yeah. What's the biggest story? And every year, the Associated Press conducts a poll of editors. And a year ago, at the end of 2014, the top story in the AP poll was the police killing in Ferguson, Missouri, and elsewhere. That is, the death of African-Americans at the hands of police and the investigations and protests that ensued. So that similar story placed fifth this year in the AP poll. What do you think is the biggest story? It is.
It's got to be terrorism.
Drum roll, please. Yes, it's actually the Islamic State and related stories. Yeah. But number two, actually, is one we hadn't mentioned here, is gay marriage.
Supreme Court.
The Supreme Court ruling, absolutely. And it really enabled gays to marry in all 50 states. It is a huge change in American society.
Yes, but Rex, and a good one from my point of view. But Rex, when you say this, it's very interesting. I'd love to know how you editors decide what your vote is going to go for. So if it's ISIS, it seems to me that the number one issue in that is fear. Mm-hmm. I think fear is why people vote. I think it's why they think a story is worth reading. And that may not mean it's the most important story of the year.
Interesting point.
The
climate change
may have been more important.
Climate change ends up number eight on this list this year.
Exactly. But climate change could be the reason that the world is going to collapse.
Very good point. Absolutely.
And of these 10, when we do have the list in front of us, we should be transparent about that. I do. Seven of the top 10 stories as voted by editors in this AP poll, the Associated Press, seven of the 10 were about shootings, terrorism, or violence.
Wow, that makes sense.
The world is on edge, and again, yes, is it the most newsy, quote unquote, in the old traditional meaning, or is it the most relevant? But you know, a lot of people, they're just desensitized. I think they're numb to all every day. The shooting yesterday, the shooting the day before, shooting. It's like every day.
You know, there's a piece in the paper this morning. The United States has released where its ballistic missiles would have hit had we gotten into a nuclear war.
Wow.
And as opposed to in Moscow and those places. Mm-hmm. However, the bigger story might be where theirs would hit.
Yes.
Let's see if we can ferret that out.
Well, one doesn't have to have much of an imagination to realize that if you're sitting next to a nuclear facility, it's targeted.
You can guess.
Yeah.
All right. Well, that's all we've got time for.
No.
For the Media Project. It's true.
It should be an hour.
That's it. Dr. Alan Chartok, Stu Shinsky of the Poughkeepsie Journal, Rex Smith of the Times Union. We are grateful to you all for joining us on the Media Project.
Indeed.
They claim to represent the common people.
Funny, Wall Street never has complained. Ah, but publishers have worries, for publishers must go to working folks for readers and to big shots for their dough. Now publishers are such interesting people. It could be prostitution, I don't know. Ting-a-ling-a-ling, circulation, ting-a-ling-a-ling, advertising, get those readers, get that payoff. What a headache, what a mess. Oh, publishers are such interesting people. Let's give three cheers for freedom of the press.